nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. Now, that is a much preached text. It's a very good text. Many times we commit the fallacy of informal logic in figuring all the ways that salt, all the roles that salt plays, all the ways we use salt in our modern world, and impose that on this text. Francis Schaeffer says that this text teaches that we should add zest to the world. Well, I think we should add zest to the world, but the Bible doesn't say that. Schaeffer said that. Some men think that because salt is bitter, that it is our job as preachers to add alkali to the gospel mixture. And some have been doing that. I know a few preachers who seem to think that salt is to be used the way the world uses it, a salty joke, ribald. The Bible certainly doesn't mean that. It says you are the salt of the earth. It doesn't mean our language is to be salty in that sense. What does it mean? Well, I studied this for a long time. I'm going to give you, going in, my understanding of how this is used. Then we'll look at how the scriptures use it and try to learn something from it. When Jesus said, "You are to his disciples, you are the salt of the world, salt of the earth," what did he mean? Well, he means this. Now, here's the statement. I'm going to speak slow so you can write it down. Then I'm going to spend the next 20 minutes or so talking about it. But we are salt in this sense. Salt, as Jesus uses it metaphorically, is that which upon first taste, makes us go toy. Now that's, wait a minute, I'll get to that. Now, that's, being a college professor, I feel called upon to get academic. There's a Greek word called, the Greek word pronounced tuo. Now you semi-literates are laughing because you think I made that up, but I didn't. Tuo. It means to spit. It's an onomatopoetic word with which the sound of it suggests the meaning. We pronounce it's that which, salt is that which upon first taste makes us go doy. Seized on that back when I was at Bible College in Cincinnati, we were very sophisticated and intellectual in our humor. We used to think it was a great thing to switch the salt and the pepper, the salt and pepper shakers into salt in the sugar bin, I'm starting to say. Salt in the sugar, and our friend come by, and he'd go, "Today." Now, salt is that which upon first taste makes us go patooey, but which upon wise reflection we realize is salvation. Now, I use salvation there to mean God's plan for the world, using a very broad sense. Whatever God has in mind for his world, got that? I put that in that word salvation. Okay, make sure you get this. You'll see I'm a college teacher I know all the teaching and half the learning. So repeat after me. Salt. This is the biblical doctrine. That which upon first taste makes us go to it. But which upon wise reflection we realize is salvation. Now in Matthew 5:13, Jesus is teaching this, and he uses this, the text which I have read, and he uses that statement. The context, of course, is the Sermon on the Mount, and the Sermon on the Mount is about the kingdom man. Jesus is offering a kingdom that the Jews did not want. They had their concept of the kingdom and what kind of man would make up the kingdom, starting out as a son of Abraham. And Jesus is teaching that in his kingdom is going to require a different kind of man, and that this doctrine, this kind of man, was going to contradict the Jewish national expectation. Therefore, the Jews were not going to like it. It was going to make them go patuy. They were going to reject this kingdom man. They wanted a kingdom of masters, and Jesus came offering a kingdom of servants. And Jesus is saying in this text, you're the salt of the earth. He's saying, if I understand it, if you are not this kind of kingdom man, you're good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You understand? You are not going to fulfill my plan for the world if you are not this kind of man. And then he says, you're the salt of the earth. Now, he uses this in Luke chapter 14. He uses this figure, salt, in a slightly different way. And this is very instructive. He is sifting the multitudes. Look at Luke 14:25. Now great multitudes were going along with him, and he turned to them and said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, and you're familiar with the rest of that, he sifts the multitudes. You see, there were many who had an idea that they wanted to follow Jesus, but not very many really had what it took to make the kind of commitment that he was going to require of his inner circle of disciples. And so he is sifting them. You really want to follow me? And in this sifting, in Luke chapter 14, come down to verse 34, he says, therefore salt is good, but even if salt has become tasteless, with what will it be seasoned? Now, what he's saying here is, if I understand it, it requires a special kind of sacrifice to become that which will save that which is worth saving. We get that? It will take a special kind of sacrifice to become that which will save that which is worth saving. And if you start and quit, that's the context of Luke 14. If you start and quit, you can read that text. I'm not going to study it with you because of the time. Then you have lost your saltiness. Do we really want to follow him? Very close to his use of it in Matthew 5, slightly different. In Mark 9, we have the most fascinating use of the figure salt. If you look at the situation there, he has been on the Mount of Transfiguration with his disciples, and they come down, and immediately they start acting like we would act. They start debating over who is going to be first in the kingdom. Who's going to be Mr. Big Man? And so, in the context they're jealous about a man who's casting out demons and who's not one of them. And so Jesus, these men have seen the glory of Christ, the transfigured glory of Christ, and then they immediately get right down to some very low kind of bickering. And then he gives them again this figure of salt. Mark 9, 45 and 50, he says, for everyone will be salted with fire. Now in the context, he said, if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. Verse 45, verse 47, if your eye causes you to stumble, cast it out. For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if the salt becomes unsalty, with what will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. Quit arguing. Quit debating over the chief seats in the kingdom. Have some salt in you. What does that mean? Well, you're going to be salted with fire. That is, you are going to undergo that which is going to make you go patuy. You're going to face it, fellas. And it's going to be tough, but on wise reflection, you're going to realize that it was worth it. It had to be done. And so he says, begin now to accept this salt, have this salt in you, kill your ego, put your pride in your back pocket, get into the kingdom mind, begin to be salted so that, and here's the great biblical principle this text teaches, and I wish I had time to talk for an hour or two about this. The Bible teaches this very clearly, that if we are children of God, then we are going to be subject to discipline. And the discipline that we do for ourselves, he will not have to do for us. But if we will not do it for ourselves, and we're serious about being his servants, he'll do it for us. And so he's saying, accept this salt, be salted. You're going to be salted. The judgment is coming. The trials are coming. The pressure's coming. But right now, he says, you get on with this business. Now, so you can see in each case, the figure salt is used differently. But overall, that is the statement. That which, whatever it is, the kind of person we're going to be, if we're going to contradict this world, if we're going to be different enough from this world, we are going to have to accept in ourselves that which is very disagreeable, very bitter, but upon wise reflection, we'll see it was for the best, in order that we might offer to the world that which it is going to see as salt, very disagreeable, makes it go patooey. But upon wise reflection, it will see that it's the best. Did you get that? I'm going to say it again. That's the way the summary of this New Testament use of the word salt. We must accept in ourselves that which is bitter and hard sometimes. And we want, and our first reaction is to reject it, say, not for me. But if we'll accept it, if we'll be salted, then after the fact we'll realize that in terms of the God's plan for this world, it was the best. And then and only then will we be in a position to offer to the world that which it is first going to reject, which will save it. Now that's my understanding of teaching the New Testament. Salt, as Jesus used it. Now, what does this mean to us? Well, the church, the gospel is the proper balance between salt and sugar. And in many areas today, I suspect that the it's out of balance. You'll forgive me if this sermon seems out of balance. I am speaking today on behalf of the Ministry of Salt. Now, the Ministry of Salt is the ministry of loving rebuke and kindly contradiction. That's what salt does, as Jesus used it. Understand? Loving rebuke. We accept it in ourselves for ourselves, and we offer it to the world that the kingdom might come. Now, let me say this in defense of myself, if I need to defend myself, that this out of balance is okay, because it'll be put in balance, because for every sermon you hear which is salty, you'll hear 100 that's full of maple syrup. If I preached on salt for 6 hours today and 6 hours tomorrow, I'd still be on the losing side on the overall balance. You see, the church today wants a non-controversial gospel. And I'll just say this to you young people here, young preachers. If controversy gives you the highs, you're in the wrong religion. Now, first of all, as I've suggested, we need to have salt in ourselves. That is, Jesus taught his disciples that they had to decide if they were willing to pay the price, hear me, to pay the price to be different enough to be salt in the generation. With that, he sifted the crowds. It means to submit to a kind of spiritual discipline that he talked about in Mark 9 that kills ego and self. And the question is, has our discipleship ever cost us anything that made us go patooey? You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, if the gospel isn't true, the Christian life is such a grand life that even if it's not true, it's a good way to live. Brother, if you say that, your discipleship probably hasn't cost you very much. Paul never said that. Paul lists in the Corinthians letter his list of sufferings as long as your arm. And Paul lived his life in such a way that I'm pretty sure he said, if I come to the end of my life and find the gospel is not true, I've been an absolute fool. I went through all this for nothing. You hear me? If you think, and this is an opinion, I may be wrong. If you don't agree, it may be because you're right. If you think the Christian life is a dandy life, just kind of a sweet, nice way to live, and even if it's not true, it's still been a sweet, nice way to live, then there has been very little salt in your life, perhaps. Brother, listen, that is not my testimony. My testimony, if it's not true, it's not worth it. Now, do we represent a rebuke or a contradiction personally to the world or to a worldly church? Do we make the world or the worldly uncomfortable? Now, one of my favorite stories, and it's true, it's supposed to be true, Herodotus tells it. He loved a good story, so he put it in whether he thought it was true or not. Herodotus tells a story about the time when Croesus, this king of legendary wealth, king of Lydia, he rebelled against Cyrus the Persian. And Cyrus took the city of Lydia, took Lydia, the king of Lydia, and he was about to lay the city in ruins and kill all the men, lest the city rise in rebellion again. And Croesus, trying to save his city from destruction, he said to Cyrus, look, you don't have to destroy the city and to kill all the men. I got another plan. Here's what he said. As for the Lydian, in other words, another plan, how you can make sure they don't ever rebel again, cause you any more trouble. Got that? He said, do this. As for the Lydians, forgive them. But at the same time, if you want to keep them loyal and prevent danger from them in the future, I suggest that you put a veto up on their possession of weapons. Make them wear tunics under their cloaks. Make them put on underwear. And high boots. And tell them to teach their sons to play the zither and the harp and start shopkeeping. If you do that, my lord, you'll soon turn them into women instead of men. And there'll be no more danger. They're rebelling against you. He said, you don't have to kill them. Just sissify them. right about that, and I am. Then Satan has very successfully made sure that the church of our generation, I'm generalizing now, will be no threat to him in the future. The church is not going to really rebel against his system because he has pretty effectively sissified us. I just finished reading a book, by the way. I can't think of the author. The name escapes me. It's called The Missing from Action. Nelson Publishing puts it out. You guys got to get that book and read it. It points out quite accurately that it, not just in the church, but in America, the moral leadership of our society has been turned over to the women. And the women don't want it. Just look in society. We have mothers against drunk driving, putting the dads in jail. Take my word for it, you can't get men to fight abortion, to walk the picket line. I walked the picket line before the abortion clinic there in Orlando. It's two or three men, all the rest of them women. Where are the men? Home mowing the lawn. Our children are taught, our little boys are taught by women. Bible school teachers are taught by women. Public school teachers, the women run the religion in the home, and then we expect these men to be the patriarchs of the church. They don't know how to do it. Well, it's going to take the kind of salt that men are responsible for giving. I would to God that we could de-sissify this generation of the church. Amen. Raise up men who are still men enough to represent a threat to the world and to a worldly church. Men about whom the world and the world, worldly, will say patui. But about whom, upon wise reflection, the world and the worldly will say, without that man, I would have been lost. That's salt. What about the church? That's salt in ourselves. What about salt for the church? Well, church in many areas of Florida, I can speak for my own area, is dying of sugar diabetes. Now, the church is out of balance. You know, sugar is like not like salt. Salt really tastes bad at first, but after a while you realize you had to have it. Sugar, on the other hand, tastes sweet at first, like candy to a child. The first bite, you ever notice it? First bite, you thought, well, I can eat this whole box. I can eat this all day. After about the 10th piece, you go, yuck. After about the 20th, you go, erp. I mean, you can only take so much sugar. I'm for grace and love and patience, but I'm just very honest with you. I can only take so much sweetness and light. Remember that? The church is getting over this now. Some churches used to have love feasts. I used to go around and preach. I preached in 30 or 40 different churches a year, and I got so sick of love feasts. Some of the most worldly churches were having love feasts. That's the only thing that happened in the whole service that anybody ever smiled about. And frankly, it got kind of puky. I mean, I don't mean to be indelicate. But, you know, after I've smiled and looked everybody in the eye and hugged them and held their hand and told them how sweet they were, I want some salt because I need it to contradict my life, my sin. Now, the church is sweet. I could list some specific areas, but I won't. I just remember that I have to think of Herodotus, who told the story about Croesus and Cyrus. Herodotus said that the Babylonians buried their dead in honey. Think about that. I've known many a dead church been buried in honey. church discipline? Rebuke, contradict the ministry of Saul? What would happen in most churches if the elders tried to discipline that handful of neurotics who've been killing the kingdom for the last 20 years or so? I tell you, told them to get out. It'd surprise everyone. The church would spit. They would say, you can't do that. I'm quoting, you can't do that. Why? Well, her husband gave us the ground to put this church on. You can't tell her anything about her life. You can't stop her tongue. You can't do that. But upon wise reflection, if we did it, they would say, you have saved the church from the death of mediocrity. Calvinism says, let Jesus come into your heart. That's sweet. The gospel says, repent and obey the gospel. That's both sweet and salty. I mentioned inerrancy. You want to make somebody spit today, you raise that issue. It's been declared officially a non-issue. It's a matter of semantics. Nature, the nature of the question and the history of the argument show that the denial of inerrancy in one generation leads to apostasy in the next. This generation might go putoe if we raise the issue, but if we'll fight for the word, the next generation, upon reflection, will say, we'll call our name blessed for passing on the faith to them that will save them. Understand? We have to have some salt on this issue in this generation so our children will have life, our grandchildren. Salt. Well, last of all, and I'm not going to go over my time, salt for the world. Be salt in ourselves, and salt in the church, and salt in the world. The church is to be salty in the world. All I got to say this, people, it's about time the church made the world spit. You see, the day is over when the church and the world were enough alike, if there ever was that day, when we could get along. I think of such issues as evolution. We have men in our own institutions teaching a theistic evolution. Our children are being brainwashed. The evolutionists have lost the argument, so they've had the laws passed. That's the rule. And I've done business with them. I've been in the trenches with them. Their rule is, don't debate, legislate. Boy, do they get mad. Abortion? What's the church doing? I think it's time for us, for the ladies group, if they're going to fight this battle, and the men aren't, at least quit making doilies and get out and confront the death merchants. We've had enough trips to the park and ceramics classes and physical fitness. I'll tell you, I get disturbed at church. I know a church that four mornings a week has a physical fitness class. Two blocks down the road, the babies are dying. Now, it's to the utter shame of the church that they're not trying to burn the church buildings down. I'm humiliated that the abortionists, the death merchants, aren't trying to bomb the churches. They ought to be. Several, but you see, if we'll confront them, and it was not going to hurt. Several weeks ago, we were out on the abortion clinic. I think my son Adam was with me. He was. And we took our youth group out there. We were marching up and down, and people came by, and they would swing over to the curb and say various things, you know. And most of them were for us. A few of them weren't. And our kids really got some obscenities flung at them. They got some salutes that the world will use, you know. One guy went by and showed us how many friends he had before his dog died. But you know, that didn't hurt our kids. That didn't hurt our kids. They get that kind of stuff all the time. At least they got it for the right reason. Salt. We think of pornography and humanism. An evangelist. How many people will go to hell because no Christian would offend them? You see, if we'll lovingly preach the gospel, whether it offends them or not, many will say, you made me so mad that now I thank you for you saved me for eternity. That's what salt is. Now, it's time that somebody cuss the church beside the preacher. You see, I wish I had time to develop this, but this generation, those young people over in that tent over there, if I know what I'm supposed to know, what I get paid to teach, those young people are going to be the first generation who are going to really understand the New Testament in a dynamic way, impossible to us, because they're going to be the first generation since the second century who are going to live in a world that is precisely pagan in the way that the first century world was. know, the paganism of the ancient Near East was many, many thousands of years old. Very deep. At least they had the same categories. At least when the gospel preachers used words like right and wrong, good and evil, at least the pagans had the categories. They knew what they meant by that language. And all the gospel teachers had to do was to put the correct content into those categories. That explains, by the way, much of the language, the word selection by Paul and by John. They would take these existing categories and put the right content into them and convert them. But today, even the categories are gone. You can talk about sin and evil. They don't even know what you're talking about anymore. It's a deadly kind of paganism. And our children are going to grow up in it. And if there's no salt in our kids, they're not going to make it. They aren't going to make it. Whitehead, in his book, The Stealing of America, says this. I don't know how many read quotes. I'm going to read this one. Christians naively believe that they can retreat into a zone of social and political impotence, and therefore social and political irresponsibility, just as they've done for over a century. As a whole, modern evangelism, because of its pietistic base, the very thing our brother was talking about earlier, where we give our testimony of what Jesus has done for us, because of its pietistic base, has had little effect on our modern culture. As a consequence, the enemy is at the gates. Like Joab, contemporary Christians are discovering that the horns of the altar no longer protect them from destruction. They can no longer be, quote, nice Christians, the beneficiaries of the endless fruits of a former Christian culture, hiding in their nice colleges, nice churches, and nice ministries. There are no safety zones in the combat of faith. The only way to be effective is to apply true Christianity consistently to the culture in all its aspects. That's a mouthful. You see, what's happening is we're testifying with our little inner light message, and the world isn't listening. And it needs salt. You understand what I'm saying? The church, by and large, is offering sugar to the world. Jesus said, you're the salt of the earth. Well, here's the conclusion, pretty much. If we don't become salt in ourselves, accept this salting that's going to change us, and offer this salt to the world, then we are good for nothing, Jesus says, to be thrown away. But to be thrown away. And Jesus will look for someone else. Great paradoxical question is, do we love the world enough to contradict it so we can save it through Christ? Now, it's like my children. A fellow told me one time he loved his kids too much to spank them. I said, well, if I were you, I'd be ready to go see him in jail. When Xerxes, and I seem to be talking ancient history this morning, but that's what I teach. Xerxes, if you recall reading ancient history, was marching on Greece. Asia was going to invade Europe. Xerxes had the largest army that the ancient world had ever known. Literally in the millions. And he was going to succeed where